Hi, I'm Scott Hensley.
And I'm Adam Cole, and this is Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk.
This week, April Fulton and Rebecca Davis are on spring break.
That's right.
So bear with us. They've left us alone, and we will do our best to twiddle the knobs without their guidance.
On this week's show, we've got two springy stories. We'll hear about a new kind of bug spray, and we'll join Nancy Shute as she forages for wild greens.
Don't doze off on us, but we will be talking about falling asleep on the job, and John Hamilton will explain some scientists' efforts to recognize Alzheimer's earliest stages.
And Scott, you'll update us on some recent posts from NPR's health blog, Shots.
That's right. But first, the search for a new all-natural insect repellent. NPR's Richard Knox says researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are working on a bug repellent they hope most people will actually use. There's a secret ingredient: grapefruit.
Right now, the leading bug repellent is DEET, but lots of people don't like it because it has a greasy feel and a chemical smell. At the CDC's laboratories in Fort Collins, Colorado, bug expert Mark Dolan and his team have come up with a new repellent. Dolan rubs some of it on his right hand.
It's non-greasy, dries very quickly, and it has a very pleasant citrusy grapefruit odor to it.
It's an extract of the Alaska yellow cedar tree.
So I'm opening up the cage.
To try it out, Dolan puts his hand into a cage that contains 50 hungry mosquitoes.
The ones on the wall, I'm placing my hand next to, and they try to get away in the opposite direction as quickly as they can.
No mosquitoes are landing on his hand, and now he puts his other hand, unprotected by any repellent, into another mosquito cage.
Within a matter of seconds, I had mosquitoes feeding on my untreated hand, and I still do not have any mosquitoes on my treated hand.
And 5 minutes later, they're still not biting. The stuff on Dolan's treated hand is called Nootkatone. In addition to cedars, it's also found in grapefruit and other citrus, and in some herbs and grasses. Nootkatone is so non-toxic, you could drink it. In fact, it's already an approved food additive and a natural ingredient in some foods.
If you've had a grapefruit, you've consumed some Nootkatone, or drank a squirt, for instance.
He says Nootkatone could be put into soaps and sunscreens. That way, people wouldn't have to apply a separate bug repellent. The reason the CDC is doing this research is that bug bites transmit dangerous infections, such as Lyme disease and West Nile virus. The government has licensed its Nootkatone patent to a company that will make the repellent and sell it. And here's a remarkable thing. Nootkatone could be both a repellent and an environmentally friendly pesticide. That's because it doesn't just repel bugs, it kills them. Dolan's colleague Nick Pinella demonstrates.
It sounds like a mosquito, this thing.
Pinella uses a vacuum pump to transfer mosquitoes into a jar. He's coated the inside of it with Nootkatone.
Okay, I think that's enough.
As soon as they're in the jar, the mosquitoes begin to die. Here's Mark Dolan.
Already in that short duration, there's only two mosquitoes. Was there three left alive? This stuff has incredible knockdown, so it kills things very, very quickly. Usually within a matter, depending on the concentration, in about 15 seconds.
It kills by blocking receptors on insects' nerve cells, receptors humans don't have. It makes them hyperactive. They basically shake themselves to death.
Yeah, they buzz around on their back. Usually they get completely disoriented, and then eventually they keel over.
It works in a completely different way from other insecticides, so mosquitoes aren't resistant to it yet. And Nootkatone works on other insects too, ticks, which transmit Lyme disease, and probably bedbugs and head lice. But don't look for the new repellent this season. Human trials are just getting started, so it'll be a couple of years at least before you can scare away bugs with the scent of grapefruit. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Here's a good reason to be outside this spring: gathering nutritious wild greens. That's right, there's a movement to bring wild food back into our diets. So NPR's Nancy Shute goes out foraging and finds out how to eat wild food safely.
Walk out the front door here at NPR, and the only place I see to get food is a hot dog cart. But Sam Thayer sees this landscape differently.
I'm looking for plants.
Sam Thayer is an edible wild plant expert. He's convinced that he can come up with a great fresh salad on the streets of Washington, D.C.
Here's something.
He starts finding edible plants right away.
Henbit and dead nettle. They're both in the mint family. They're both edible, but they're not, well, let's see. Would I want that in my salad? No.
Just because Sam loves foraging doesn't mean he'll eat just any old plant. Some aren't tasty enough. Others aren't safe. A few are just too urban. Like this prickly lettuce growing at the base of an office building.
Prickly lettuce is the ancestor of cultivated lettuce. This one is covered with some sort of dust from the building, so we wouldn't be collecting this.
That dust could contain toxic lead from paint. And I'm also wondering about things like dog pee.
If you're picking from a spot that looks like it's a dog pee kind of spot, then rinse it off or don't pick there. But the big worry is spraying of herbicides.
What should people do to make sure they're not getting plants with herbicides on them?
When people are spraying, it's usually evident from the vegetation. So if there's any oddities to the way the plants are growing, that should be a serious red flag. I'd like to look at that plant.
Thayer likes to forage in wooded areas and empty lots. He says he can usually find 14 or 15 different edible plants within arm's reach.
Most people only eat a few different vegetables over the course of a year, but anywhere you live, there's probably 75 different wild vegetables you can add to your diet.
But we didn't find enough for a meal until we hit the wild salad jackpot.
Look at that.
It was growing in an abandoned brick flower box next to an old building. And it was full of plants like shepherd's purse.
I just love the flavor of those stems, raw or cooked. If you can find a big patch of this and get enough for a whole meal, it is absolutely gourmet.
There's henbit, too, and chickweed, and prickly lettuce and wood sorrel. But what really makes Thayer swoon is the sow thistle.
That is good. Oh, Nancy, you got to try this.
Oh, man, that is good.
You cannot buy anything that good. It's like celery without the stringiness. But the flavor is like the sweetest lettuce you ever had in your mouth.
So right here, next to a parking lot in downtown D.C., we've got a big gourmet salad. But I'm wondering if these greens really are that good for you. John Kalis says yes. He's a wild food expert and a Ph.D. nutritionist. He says wild greens are a big reason why the Mediterranean diet is so healthy.
Greeks on the island of Crete ate huge quantities of greens, and they were the healthiest people of all the different people all over the world. You know, no heart disease, less dementia with old age, almost no cancers, period. So we've got 4 cups of nettles.
Kalis is making a wild greens frittata at his office in Portland, Oregon.
3 cups of field mustard greens, 2 cups of curly dock, and 1 cup of garlic mustard.
By using so many different greens, Kalis is ensuring that he's getting lots of nutrients. The mustard garlic that's going into this frittata is a common weed.
According to my research, garlic mustard is the most nutritious leafy green ever analyzed up to this point.
It's really high in vitamin A, beta-carotene, zinc, manganese, and fiber. But then, so are the other greens going into the pan.
So we take the whole mass of 10 cups of greens, throw it right on top. Lots and lots of greens. They're covering the whole pan.
Eat this frittata for breakfast and you're good for the day. But there's one must-know thing about eating wild. Don't eat a plant if you're not absolutely certain what it is. Kalis says mistakes can be dangerous or even deadly.
Poison hemlock and wild carrot look alike. Unfortunately, when people don't know what they're doing and they find something that they think is wild carrot, it actually is poison hemlock. And so they eat it, and then, you know, they die.
So before you start foraging, it's essential to study up with field guides or a class.
You need to be confident that you know the plant. It can't be just, I think I've got it. You know, you really need to be confident.
But learning wild greens can pay off.
Boy, if you can just walk around your neighborhood and get sustenance without having to go to the store, you don't need any money. That's an amazing thing. That's fun.
Nancy Shute, NPR News.
Will you go, lassie, go? And we'll all go together to Bull Wild Mountain Time, all around the blue.
And now, Scott, let's talk about some posts from the blog this week. What have you got for us?
First, we've got a post about the acai berries, these miraculous fruit from the
Amazon that are
supposed to help you lose weight. And the Federal Trade Commission put the kibosh on, or is trying to put the kibosh on 10 different websites that look like news sites. You go there and you see the logos of CNN, Fox News, NPR I haven't seen yet, but Consumer Reports was on one of them, and they tout all the benefits of these fruit, and if you click on any of the links, they take you to places where you can buy them. And the FTC has alleged and filed complaints in court that these were fake news sites that were designed to mislead consumers and get them to buy this stuff without revealing their connection to the sellers of the of the berries and some of the fair balance about do the things really work.
So is it just common sense, or are there things you can do to avoid falling into these traps?
There are some things. In fact, in the Post, we have a video from the Better Business Bureau, which had fielded a lot of complaints about things to look for and things to avoid. One thing you can do, and I think this is common sense, but it bears repeating, before you actually click on the link, just move your mouse over and see where it's going to take you. You can look in most browsers, and it'll give you a preview of where it will go. And if it doesn't look right, just skip it. I think the other advice is eternal, which is, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And that was the gist of what the FTC was saying was wrong about these places.
I also saw a post about insurance complications with organ donation.
This is a wrinkle in the organ donation area that I had not ever thought about. Michelle Andrews from Kaiser Health News, who writes for us pretty regularly, did a post about, if someone is uninsured and donates an organ, the recipient's insurance usually covers the direct costs of the procedure. But there could be some catches. So, for instance, you may need some kinds of tests or medicines like painkillers a while after the procedure that might not be covered. And probably the biggest hitch would be if you try to buy insurance later on, you might have trouble getting it because another insurer might not look too well on you if you've only got one kidney.
So that sounds a little discouraging, Scott. Should we not be donating our organs?
I think people in the field would say, please come ahead and do it. Just be mindful of some of these things and work with the transplant centers to see what you can do about them. It's also something that should be fixed by the sweeping federal health overhaul law, because by 2014, one way or another, people in this country are supposed to have insurance. So it should be a temporary condition.
Gotcha. Well, one of the things we cover a lot on the blog is generic drugs.
Everybody's familiar with the brand names because the drug companies spent a lot of money getting those burned into our brains. So whether it's Lipitor or Zocor for lowering cholesterol, or something like Nexium, the purple pill for heartburn. People are pretty familiar with those kinds of drugs. But the brands only last for so long. The patents run out, and when they do, then many companies can make the same ingredient and sell it, usually very cheaply. So now, 3 out of 4 prescriptions in the United States are filled with generic drugs, and that is an all-time high. The actual figure is about 78%, and it'll probably go even higher later this year when Lipitor goes off patent.
Hmm. So is that a good thing? Is that proportion a good thing for consumers, or is it a bad thing?
It's pretty good for consumers. So for most categories of medicines that people take regularly, blood pressure medicines, cholesterol medicines, antidepressants, antibiotics, just think about the stuff that pops up in people's medicine chests. Most of those categories now have multiple generic drugs available at a very low cost. If you have to buy them out of pocket, they can be cheap. But for those of us who have insurance, you also would pay the lowest copayment. And that was another thing that came out. The average copayment dropped by about 20 cents this year. So that's another generic effect. It's kind of bad for the drug companies. And that is that some of these companies are losing their cash cows. But for consumers, that's pretty good news.
Well, great. Well, you can check out all those stories and more at npr.org/shots.
A group of scientists has proposed new guidelines for diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. Michelle Norris spoke with NPR's John Hamilton about their goal, getting doctors to recognize Alzheimer's earlier.
The guidelines call for doctors to recognize people who are likely to develop Alzheimer's, as well as those who already have the mental impairments associated with the disease. NPR science correspondent John Hamilton is here in the studio to talk about all this. John, why are they making this change?
The biggest reason is that right now, most doctors are using diagnostic criteria that came out in 1984. Most researchers thought that if you didn't have a problem with memory or thinking, your brain was probably okay. But since then, it's become pretty clear that the brain can start to change a decade or more before it gets hard to remember things.
So what is it that starts to change? What can they detect?
Well, you can start to see things like the brain shrinking, plaques developing in the brain. You can start to see things change in the spinal fluid. Those are all things that they say really are just for scientific studies right now, for experiments. But you can also see things like much milder conditions than Alzheimer's. You have what's called mild cognitive impairment. And that's where it's not interfering with your life. You don't forget where you live or something. But if you do tests, you can see subtle changes that mean you just don't remember things or you don't think quite as clearly as you used to.
So if they can spot these things early on, what difference would that make?
Well, in a lot of ways, it really won't make any difference, at least not for patients. It's not going to change how you treat Alzheimer's. It's not going to change what doctors do. But what it is going to change is if doctors actually start following these guidelines and diagnosing people earlier with milder symptoms, it's going to really increase the number of people who fall into this sort of larger Alzheimer's category. You know, right now, the statistics show that there are more than 5 million people in the U.S. with Alzheimer's. But the scientists think that there are at least that many more people who have these less serious forms. So you could look like there was just this explosion in the Alzheimer's numbers.
Will this help people who have Alzheimer's?
There's a lot of debate about that. You know, the problem is that right now, there really aren't any drugs that work to treat Alzheimer's. Knowing that you have it doesn't mean that you're going to get an intervention that's going to make any difference. Now, you've got groups like the Alzheimer's Association that say, well, it can be helpful to know that, you know, you're in the earliest stages of this disease. Maybe you decide to draw up a will or arrange for long-term care. On the other hand, you have people who say, well, you know, learning that you have this thing that might be a terminal disease, you might not want to carry that information around with you.
Jen, are there other reasons to diagnose people earlier?
Well, there might be if you were, you know, trying to plan to care for a loved one that you think might be in the early stages. It might help your planning there. On the other hand, one of the problems here is that let's say you get diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment. It doesn't necessarily go on to lead to Alzheimer's. So you're not really given a very firm diagnosis. There are also reasons, you know, if you are one of the groups that advocates for people with Alzheimer's disease, if there is more awareness of it because many more people are falling in the diagnostic category, you know, it's going to be good for you. It'd be easier to get money for it. And also, if you're a scientist doing research on people with Alzheimer's disease, everybody agrees that if any of these treatments are going to work, they're probably going to work best on people in the very earliest stages. And so you can't try that out unless you've identified a bunch of those people and gotten them into scientific studies.
That's NPR's John Hamilton. John, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
There are some job requirements that seem so obvious that you hardly need to point them out. For example, it doesn't say in the NPR employee manual that you aren't supposed to fall asleep when hosting a live news program.
It's not surprising, then, that outrage greeted the news that some air traffic controllers had fallen asleep on the job. Still, working the overnight shift is tough. As NPR's Joe Palca reports, willpower and good intentions may not be enough to keep you awake when your body is telling you it's time to sleep.
Humans are not nocturnal, but modern society demands some people work at night. So, is there anything you can do to be certain that people will stay awake during the graveyard shift?
I usually say no when I get that question.
Torbjörn Åkerstedt is a sleep researcher at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm.
Night work is unphysiological. You can never make it as good as day work.
What Åkerstedt means by unphysiological is our bodies have an internal clock that's designed to keep us alert during the day and asleep at night. And that clock is set by the time the sun rises and sets. So any kind of night work is tough. But
there are several varieties of night work that are worse than other times.
Such as?
If you have very short rest periods between shifts.
That's because getting enough sleep before a night shift starts is important for staying up. But there's a problem.
If I give you 12 hours of sleep by day, you're still going to be impaired at 2 o'clock in the morning because your clock doesn't adjust.
Tom Roth is a sleep researcher at the Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. So what can you do at 2 in the morning when your internal clock is telling you to sleep? Roth says a nap during your shift might help. But Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood has apparently ruled that out for air traffic controllers. Here's LaHood on Fox News Sunday.
On my watch, controllers will not be paid to take naps.
LaHood says the government's plan is to give controllers an extra hour off between shifts. Tom Roth is not convinced that's the way to go.
But I'd rather see that hour of extra sleep at 2 to 4 in the morning when the person's really impaired in that hour.
Roth says anyone who's experienced jet lag knows what it feels like when your body is tugging at you to fall asleep. The difference is when you fly halfway around the globe, the light changes with you, and the light of the local daytime helps you shift your internal clock. You can shift your internal clock artificially with bright lights at night and dark curtains during the day, but it's tough and hard to maintain. It's also true that some people can handle jet lag or night shift work more easily than others.
You have people that are short sleeper, people that are long sleeper.
Maurice Ohayon is a sleep researcher at Stanford University. Not only do people vary on the amount of sleep they need, there are also differences in when they need their sleep. Larks tend to like to go to sleep early and get up early. For night owls, it's the opposite. But Ohayon says everyone will experience times when they get sleepy in the middle of the night.
Here is the biggest problem. We know that sleepiness is something that is taking you by surprise. You don't know when you are passing from sleepiness to sleep.
In other words, if you become excessively sleepy, you can fall asleep and not realize it.
You are always at risk to have a big episode of excessive sleepiness. The sleep can come at any moment. The danger is there.
So if you're always at risk for this, why don't we see more accidents or near misses in people who are doing critical jobs in the middle of the night?
We are lucky.
Not a particularly comforting thought, but it does mean it will take more than threats from angry politicians to keep people awake and vigilant in the middle of the night. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Children don't get weary, children don't get weary, children don't get weary,
till your work is done,
children.
And that's all for Your Health this week. I'm Scott Hensley.
And I'm Adam Cole. You can see all the newest blog posts or browse through our archives at npr.org/shots.
And don't worry, next week, your hosts, Rebecca and April, will be back, and I will be on spring vacation.
Thanks for listening.
Keep going.